My name is Jillian McCain. I live in New York City. I co-wrote a book with Legs McNeil called Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk, which is now celebrating its 20th anniversary with a new edition put out by Grove Press, with a new afterword by the authors, more photos, and more fun stuff.
How has it been this year talking about this book all the time?
Yeah, I try to kind of do a reread, and it's just still so memorized, I can't reread it like it's someone else's book. It's just so imprinted in my brain.
So it took 5 years to write the whole thing.
Three and a half, four. We did all the interviews. People want to talk about what they want to talk about, and we didn't have a real agenda when we started the book. The only mission statement we had was that punk started in New York, not London. So you learn a lot, just people telling stories, obviously, but there's also stories that you want to hear about, especially as the book goes along, because, you know, you're seeing like Iggy went to see the Doors here. We need another perspective on that. Oh, did you go see the Doors there? Maybe we made it sound in the oral history essay like it's just all free-floating, but it's really well thought out. It's just we don't take in written questions. It's very conversational, but we've done our homework. We're really interested in what people have to say.
Because you did so much homework and were so prepared, like how would you go into these interviews?
Well, as the time went on, you know, you've interviewed Ronnie Ashton for 10 hours. And so when you interview Scotty Ashton, you've got that frame of reference. And then when you interview Iggy 2 years later, you've got all that frame of reference. So in a way, we kind of purposefully left Iggy till the very end. We knew he'd only give us limited time. And we wanted the book kind of laid out so we knew where we wanted him to talk within the book.
This book really revolutionized that. I mean, now it is a, you know, it's a very common way for books to be written. And you guys broke from oral history, I think, being really academic to being so populist and people-oriented and alive in a way that people continue to mimic afterwards, especially for the musical modern rock
crazy,
storytelling.
Right?
Yeah, and so
I mean, we were influenced by Edie, the oral history about Edie Sedgwick by Gene Stein and George Plimpton.
Mm-hmm.
I read that book in high school, and then like maybe a year later, I read the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And when I read Edie, it wasn't in my mind like, I want to do an oral history. But it was like, I want to do a book like Edie. And then when I read the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, it was like, I just like this counterculture, fringe group story. Well, I mean, that's just what I was into. But when Legs and I met, he was a huge Edie fan too. And we're like, why don't more people use this form? It's one of the best books ever. So I don't know if you know this, but the book started out being an authorized biography of Dee Dee Ramone. Legs convinced Dee Dee that they should do it in an oral history format. So Legs was going around to Danny Fields and all these people and asking them about Dee Dee and the Ramones. And then he was doing hours and hours with Danny Fields, and Danny Fields would go on tangents about like the MC5 and the Stooges and da da da. And I had always said to Legs, this is so much bigger than the Ramones. Like, you were there. You were one of the people. You should really do an oral history of that whole scene. So when Dee Dee got a little hard to get along with, and I think Legs took my words to heart, he was like, yeah, it's got to be bigger. You want to do it with me? So that's what happened.
Was Legs a little bit resistant when you were first saying that? Because since he was involved, I think sometimes it's hard to...
I think he had started out, he thought he was just doing it about the Ramones, but he had already, right at the beginning, made it so much broader.
There was a theory that you had, you or Legs or both of you, of people not expecting this to be published, so that they were just pretty honest.
Yeah, that's Legs' theory. I mean, you got to understand, it was only, I mean, if you look at punk ending in quotations, what, like, say, 79, we started working at it in like 91. that's only 12 years later. I mean, it was still really fresh in people's mind, but the media didn't have any interest in it. I think it was far enough from when it happened that people were comfortable talking, but near enough that they remembered everything.
Yeah, it was a good sweet spot.
When I thought about it, like, that was only 12 years later, that's like, that is no time. That's like just a little more over a decade. But the way New York had turned, it was like, it was decades away. It felt like that was like 35 years before the way New York had changed and the stories people were telling us about that time. I moved to New York in 1987, so I missed all that. But I came to New York hoping to relive that, or, you know, the punk thing. At the time, I was disappointed, but now when I look from now to then, it was still really fucking great.
Absolutely.
In 1987. Yeah. Still fantastic. Just the East Village now is all like, walking down St. Mark's Place, it's almost like walking on Bourbon Street in New Orleans. Drunk frat bars. It's unbelievable. Rent is more expensive in the East Village than the Upper East Side. But I think rent is more expensive in Brooklyn than the Lower East Side. So it's just all crazy. Like, Brooklyn's supposed to be all bohemian. It's like more expensive than Manhattan.
I was out there, went to the Brooklyn Book Fair, and Jim Carroll was reading, and he's like,
"Yeah."
At the end of it, he was like, "Oh, I never should have left New York. Wow, we're just in Brooklyn." That generation of folks, like, this is New York and this is our world, and what has happened to it, you know, completely ungrounded.
He meant I should never have left Manhattan to go to Brooklyn?
Yeah. Wow. It was amazing.
I kind of like that. I'll be talking to Danny Fields and he goes, "Do you want to go to this?" And I go, "I don't know." He goes, "We can't. It's in Brooklyn." "We don't go to Brooklyn." But I mean, I go to Brooklyn and walking around, and it's so fashionable and vibrant and the streets are crowded and stuff. But it reminds me of Toronto. It's not like what the Lower East Side was. There's something really clean and safe about it, and a lot of market segment, market research going on. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it feels like the, this is my romanticization of New York, you know, but this is what I grew up romanticizing about New York, you know, and San Francisco. Is like, there were these places where the culture was really being made without outside influence and no one cared. And then it happened. Yeah. And then everyone's like, ooh, as opposed to LA, where you're like, everyone's kind of hawking and watching for the thing so they can grab it and co-opt it. And now that Brooklyn turned into LA and Portland is turning into LA, even though Portland was just a crappy logging town where they really ignored what was happening here. And we were probably the last city to have that blissful ignorance to develop a creative scene.
But with grunge, and I mean, is that what you mean by the blissful ignorance? Like, kind of organic and it all happened and then the media caught on and then kind of ruined it.
Yeah, and they definitely ruined Seattle, and we had a good couple more years before our version of that. Now they're here looking for that kind of thing, and you're like, yeah, it's gone. Partially because put a big spotlight on it and all that.
Yeah.
One of the things that, I mean, you just said this about Please Kill Me, but I hadn't really seen other people talk about, is like, no one cared yet about punk. And when you were talking about it, when I saw that about not being published, it was like, oh, not only not being published, but also it was right in the Nirvana times of like, oh, Ramones, Nirvana, it all just happened right next to each other. And did that actually change things in the time when you were working on it? I mean, I know, I don't know. Did it?
What, grunge and Nirvana?
Yeah, people actually discovering punk again in a mainstream way. Did that actually affect you working on this book?
I don't think people are listening to Green Day were going back and listening to the Stooges.
Let me rephrase this. Because the mainstream was talking about punk again while you were working on this book, did it give you any kind of glimpse that maybe people would actually read it or would actually be interested in it because punk was a mainstream topic again?
Yeah, I mean, I never felt like people wouldn't be interested. I thought people would read it and like it, but I don't look at it so much as a book on punk. It's just an epic story just about people. When my dad reads it and other people, straight people, they don't give a shit about punk or rock and roll, but they like the book. So I always felt like people would read it because of that. But Legs thought it was all about the subject matter and that no one would read it because no one thought punk was important. But then, of course, right around the time we put out the book, Sex Pistols are getting back together. You know, Patti Smith comes out of hiding. I mean, it was just like serendipity or something. It just like all happened at the same time.
As a total outsider, it did seem like, oh, here, the mainstream's been talking about this. It was like you guys, you as in the subjects, not you as Jillian McCain, the person. Mm-hmm. People care again. Now we can come out and finally get some credit instead of just being dismissed or ignored or whatever. And the audience was there musically and with the book. Culture was kind of like, oh, yes, you weren't just garbage. You were completely important.
Yeah.
Very interesting and cool.
Yeah. I'm really proud of it.
Yeah. What other kind of stuff have you been doing in the past 20 years and how has this affected the work that you've been doing?
Legs and I actually did a young adult book called Dear Nobody, The True Diary of Mary Rose. After Please Kill Me, Legs moved to LA and he did a oral history of the adult film industry. Then he moved to a small town in Pennsylvania and a friend's daughter, he was like, hey, what have you been reading lately? And she goes, well, the best thing I've read like is my friend's late sister's journals. They haven't been published, but we've been like reading them at her house and they're just incredible. So Legs was like, gee, Jillian and I would love to read those. So she got permission from the mother. Legs photocopied about 100 pages and FedExed to me. And I was just like, oh my God. We called each other up and I was like, this is our next book. And he said, yeah, totally. So it was 500 pages this girl had written between the ages of 15 and 17. Some were short stories, poems, but mainly journals and diary entries. We wanted it to read like, you know, like Please Kill Me with a narrative. And so we had to interview her mother and her sister and get like police reports, just trying to figure out like where she was at what point in her life, you know, during what year. And then we had to edit down. So it moved quickly, but we did not change a word of her work. It was all in her writing. So it's kind of starts with this trajectory. She is, her mother has to move. She moves to another small town. She's really lonely. She starts getting into drugs. And then about halfway through the book, it's revealed that she has cystic fibrosis, which sounds like maybe kind of manipulative on the part of us, but it wasn't because you'd read like 50 pages of her stuff. She wouldn't even talk about the cystic fibrosis. Mm-hmm. It was just, this guy broke my heart. This guy didn't pay attention to me. Oh man, I got so fucked up last night. It was amazing how she had compartmentalized her life. This girl would have been, I mean, she was a great writer and there's no doubt in my mind she would have become a professional writer. It's just another thing we're both really proud of. What's so great about is, you read these entries and it's, you know, it's a girl 15, 16. She hates her mother, of course. But as you read more, it comes across. You realize that she's hating her mother because her mother doesn't have enough time for her. Part of the reason she doesn't have enough time for her is like she's working, trying to pay the rent. Can you imagine like dealing with the insurance companies and the hospitals? It was like just taking care of her illness, like administration-wise, was like a part-time job. But she's dissing her mother. My mother's this, my mother's that. And so it was really amazing to me that, number one, the mother let us do this, and number two, the mother didn't change a word.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty great.
Totally.
Yeah.
When did you...
So you read the book and her mother comes across as, I mean, as an adult reading between the lines, you kind of know what's going on. But I'm sure if you're 14 and you're reading this book, you're just thinking, oh man, her mother was awful.
When did that come out again?
4 years ago, maybe. It was held up for 5 years because she died without a will. And the mother had to get, they had to reopen the whole will issue so that the mother owned everything and not the father, who was a deadbeat dad. And it was so, you know, small town in Pennsylvania. And these were literally in Hillary Scribblers, like spiral notebook, like Disney notebooks. And so I think most of the judges were just looking at this like, what is this? Like, what is it worth? How can it be worth anything? So that was really heartbreaking. 4 or 5 years later, we've almost got the legal bill paid off.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was a real labor of love.
So that's great that you and Legs have continued to work together. So you didn't just do this thing and then kind of were friends and then got hanging out all the time again with the 20th anniversary.
Right.
That's
cool. No, we had that. And I informally edited The Other Hollywood. So we always had that connection, but I didn't feel passionate enough about the subject to like really throw my life into that for 3 or 4 years. But, you know, he'd always be sending me stuff. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? What should I take out? But not officially.
Yeah, when you find a good editor and person to work with that kind of stuff, you don't let them go very lightly.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an amazing, incredible book, and it's really neat that still 20 years later that you get to go around and talk about it. What's been surprising to you about this year of celebration? And
it's just amazing because we did all these readings, and the Ace Hotel sponsored us to do these readings across the U.S., and I mean, there'd just be lines, people. And they were buying the new book. They'd bring the old book. They had the hardcover. The old books were all dog-eared. Or people would come up, oh, I loaned it to my sister and she gave it to a friend. So many people were like, it just changed my life. So that's incredible because Edie changed my life. It's just so cool to have helped do that with other people. What I'm really proud is... I think it has helped a lot of people's careers, and I'm so proud that it popularized the oral history format, which is just such a great, I mean, who wants to read what the writer thinks about something? I want to hear what the person is thinking and saying, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just totally proud of it.
The amount of people that you interviewed and then who have died is striking. For
yeah,
this book, you know, I don't really have any questions about that, but just like another, like, thank you for doing this at the time when you did it and having the foresight, because that is, seeing the list in the back of the book was like, oh, wow.
I know. And most of it was like cancer. Like for most people, there were a few drug overdoses, but a lot of Hep C, which, you know, is often drug related. But yeah, I read that list. It's just, I don't know, there were 60 people or something.
I think it was 44 when it came out,
okay.
But then I'm sure there's more this year.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. We got their voices out there. I mean, anyone we interviewed, we never heard anyone go like, you misquoted me, or I don't know. I kind of couldn't sleep before the book came out because it doesn't put everyone in a totally great light, but most people had a sense of humor about themselves, and people who are in it really love it. They're proud to be in it. Yeah.
Yeah. I would be proud if I was in it.
Me too.
Is there any last things that you wanted to say that you had been thinking about that we didn't talk about, or?
Just what we were talking about right then at the book party. Someone introduced my dad to John Waters. And John Waters said, you must be so proud of your daughter. And Dad goes, yes, I'm very proud of her. And then he leaned forward. He goes, but aren't you glad she wrote it and isn't in it? That was just, yes, absolutely.
Oh,
that was pretty good.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.